Hello, and welcome to episode 2 of the Lionskin Podcast. Welcome back if you're a returning listener, and welcome to you all who are listening for the first time. Follow my Instagram account, Lionskin Podcast, for future updates. You'll know me by the Red Panther icon. This is the Lionskin Podcast, a literature podcast in which I, your host Q Alexander, explore the various odd books that I have in the library that I have collected over the years. Tonight's book is The Silver Chair by C.S. Lewis. Now, if you follow the very nascent tale of my podcast, you will note that this was posted on Sunday, while the plan was Friday's. Well, I recorded an episode on Friday, but it was a scriptless 50-minute long mess. It was not quality content, and it's going to be locked away safely to await either destruction by the fiery hand of a solar flare or the joy of my future children. The point being, I took a risk and it did not pan out. However, as the old song goes, when we fall, we aye get up again. So I got up, got my pen out, and wrote a script. It covers the majority of what I rambled about, and that's what I'm reading right now. And now, back to the work. Silver Chair by C.S. Lewis. This book was a bit of a surprise to me. I chose it because I wanted a strange, fun book that was possibly a bit too medieval for its own good. In case you didn't know, I am an unrepentant medievalist. However, upon reread, the themes became so real, so heavy, that I almost put off this episode because of the harshness of the material. But, as Robert Burns says, the honest man, though e'er say poor, is king of men. So, I'm going to be honest and roar into this episode. So sit back, get a drink, and enjoy. The Silver Chair, published in 1953, is the sixth book in the series The Chronicles of Narnia. And we just encounter one of my personal speech impediments. I can't pronounce the word sixth properly. But anyways, this is one of those series that needs a little explanation because they have thoroughly made their mark. But if you do not know, they're a series of children's-ish stories set in a parallel universe where animals talk and Jesus takes the form of a lion. And here is the first thing that must be said about these books. They are unrepentant Christian stories taking the form of allegory, where one thing represents a deeper meaning or a truth that is the real message. This is a very popular idea and form of storytelling, and almost any movie out today will have someone out there theorizing about its deeper meanings. Some may have problems with the allegorical nature of Narnia for various reasons. For what it's worth, and since I am king in this court, it is worth a lot. I am a Christian, but find issues with the allegory because it feels a bit clunky to talk the deep theology in this way. But for the majority of the thing, and the whole corpus of books and essays he's put out, I very much admire Lewis's teachings. Who then is C.S. Lewis? First off, his initials are for Clive Staples. But he was an Irish author who has become the closest thing to a saint that a non-high church Protestant can have. You can, as a common churchy, read as many Christian authors as you can. We have our captains, our chieftains, our chevetains. Whoever you may choose, the majority of people will not really care, unless your thinker of choice has recently been involved in a scandal. But drop the name C.S. Lewis. Suddenly you have a pristine glow of a Celtic hero about you. Old ladies smile at you, people speak in hushed tones of your magnificence as you crack open your book to get the elucidation within while sitting in a local burger joint. That happened to me, by the way. Why? What did Lewis do? He wrote a lot of books and wrote them in a way that was accessible to the common man, and I cannot stress this enough, he too was a medievalist. So his books of theology and adventure. He's also a sci-fi nerd from the beginning of the genre, going back even to H.G. Wells. He was there when it all started. Easily convey an alternative way of thinking that is at its core medieval and ancient. This is in juxtaposition to the early to mid-20th century in which he lived, a genuinely bleak time that really should be considered a dark age, and has only gotten bleaker. Essentially, Lewis is a bit of fresh air in an unnatural, filthy house. These are all themes in The Silver Chair, which tends to be regarded as one of the throwaway books in the series because it's not the breakout classic, The Lion, the Witch, and the Wardrobe, and Well, it's not the others. But first, here then is a refresher, or an introduction, for the plot of The Silver Chair. The prince of the land of Narnia, Rilian, son of Caspian, is missing, and has been for 10 years. Aslan the Lion summons two English children, Eustace Scrub and Jill Pole, to Narnia to fix the problem. He gives Jill 4 signs to help on the quest. 1, tell Eustace to say hi to the first friend he meets. 2, to look for a ruined city in the north of Narnia. 3, to find words written on a rock there. And 4, to help the first person who asks for help in Aslan's name. Through a series of blunders, the first sign is missed, and they must go about the help the hard way. With the help of a secret society of owls, the children get a guide in the form of a loyal Narnian called Puddleglum, who is a pessimistic creature that looks kind of like a frog, but does not like being called a frog. It's called a marshwiggle. On the very uncomfortable road, they meet a mysterious lady and a mysterious knight who point them to a castle. They follow her recommendation and end up trapped inside a castle of giants, where they discover that the uncomfortable country they're in was the actual ruins and words they were looking for all along. Narrowly escaping that, they find themselves delving deep underground into the Narnian underworld, where they are taken prisoner by gnomes. These gnomes take them to their lord, who is the mysterious knight from before. He is a bombastic, annoying individual set on world domination and mindless service to his lady. It comes out that he is accursed, and must once a day be tied to a magical silver chair for an hour, or he will slay everything around him. But when the magic comes over him, it actually leaves him, and he is only his true self in that hour. In Aslan's name, he asks for help, and dutifully, for the first time, they set him free. He is the missing prince, and they escape the underworld and return to Narnia. So there's a lot going on there. The first things that we need to talk about are the main characters, the point of view people, Eustace Scrub and Jill Pole. They are acquaintances, not friends, who attend the same boarding school in England called Experiment House, where the headmasters do psychological experiments on students by encouraging bullying. It's important to note that C.S. Lewis hated schools. I appreciate his visceral disdain for teachers. I find it funny, especially since he was a professor himself. So Scrub and Pole, the school dehumanizes students by not using first names, find themselves cornered by bullies. By the way, props to Lewis for predicting the Stanford Prison Experiment 20-odd years before it happened. This was a knack of Lewis's. He didn't predict big things, just very weird specific things. But Scrub has been to Narnia before, and he starts talking about it as a possible escape. Pole suggests, as one does, going straight to black magic. Very out of left field and not expected at all. But magic is a major recurring theme in C.S. Lewis's writings, and in The Silver Chair in particular. Scrub gives a short summary of why it's bad. It's acting like you can control God through rituals and oddities, and says instead, we should just ask Aslan to let us in. And it just so happens that because God controls all things, that thought was not Scrub's, but Aslan's himself, and they're pulled into Narnia. And we go right to Narnian Heaven, Aslan's country, and it's fantastic. A large primal forest full of birds atop a mountain. Hoo boy, if you know me, you know I'm a bird watcher who loves forests and mountains. This is heaven. It's also biblical. In Revelation, the New Jerusalem has gates, implying countryside outside the city. And since the tone of it is that it's Eden restored, the country is wild forest and gardens. I gotta see those forests, man. Also, the Garden of Eden was on a mountain. 4 rivers flow out of it, and rivers flow downhill. Anyways, the kids discover just how close the edge of heaven is. Maintaining a heavenly mindset is a precarious thing, and they come to a sheer cliff. Pole decides to go right up to the edge, and falls. Scrub tries to save her, and falls too. But Aslan cannot let his heroes die, so he saves them. Separately. Story-wise, it builds tension, but feels a bit contrived, and it needlessly complicates things. Aslan blows Scrub into the sky towards Narnia. He then has a private talk with Pole. His status as mighty and divine lion is asserted, and he gives Pole the mission. Prince of Narnia is missing, and she and Scrub have to find him. Aslan gives the four clues and signs to help her on the quest, and then sends her off into the sky. Unfortunately, for one reason or another, Pole hesitates to tell Scrub the mission. They land at the docks of Narnia and watch the king sail away. But it turns out the king was Scrub's old friend Caspian, who is a heavyweight in the series. He has his own book, Prince Caspian, where we meet him. It's his kid who's missing, and Caspian has outlawed looking for him, meaning that the quest must be done in secret. So, in order to do it in secret, we meet Narnian Black Ops, a secret society of owls that calls itself the Parliament of Owls. It is a very vague reference to Chaucer's A Parliament of Fowls, where the birds of the earth all gather, and it's also a pun, because Parliament of Fowls, Parliament of Owls. But it's even affected English language as a whole, because now the official term for multiple owls is a parliament. That is a real feather in Lewis's cap. Another odd prediction is also in this one, this time in comic books. My personal favorite Batman villain is the Court of Owls, a relatively new creation. I think in 2012 is when they came out, but they're a secret society of evil, mean people that dress up as owls. It's an interesting coincidence. Owls are bats' natural predators. But unlike the court, the parliament are actually owls, and they end every sentence with ooh, because Lewis made all of his animals act like they're real versions. The parliament functions as Narnian's intelligence agency, breaking the rules that need to be broken. They determine that it is necessary to break Caspian's rule and help the kids find the prince. And they kindly inform the kids, and more importantly, us, what the deal is with the prince. Naturally, Narnian Black Ops gets into weird science fiction stuff. 10 years prior, the prince, whose name is Rillian, vanished, and his mother, the queen, was killed by a giant snake. All of the knights of Narnia went to find the prince and never returned. Caspian forbade the rest of his knights from going, so he did not lose all of his men. It's the interbook and inter-series implications of all this that gets fascinating. First, Caspian. He's a Telmarin, a human and a friend of Aslan. His last appearance was in Voyage of the Dawn Treader, in which he sailed to the edge of the world to find Aslan. So he's a man searching for that which is beyond. He finds it, Aslan, but also a wife. The queen is the daughter of a star. Her mother is unknown, so she's either full or half star. Either way, she's an alien. Remember, Lewis was a sci-fi nerd from the very beginning. He tends not to miss any key tropes. But it gets deeper. She's a manifestation of heavenly love, the pure kind, the godly stuff. In other writings, Lewis made the demarcation between phrases God is love and love is God. It's an important distinction to make. In the second volume of C.S. Lewis's space trilogy, his foray into science fiction, entitled Perelandra, the planet Venus is a realm that this sort of love thrives in, as it is a planet where Adam and Eve, or its version of them, who have green skin, didn't fall. It must be defended from the invasions of the Black Archon of the Silent Planet, the Earth, and the Devil. It's important to note here that C.S. Lewis liked the cornier 1930s style of science fiction, and based on his writings, probably really enjoyed John Carter, but I am not sure, and I do not quote me on that. But it seems like he would have really liked it. So, that is the queen, and her son Rillian is the offspring of a seeking man and divine love, and he is missing. Much like the suddenness of the cliff in Aslan's forest, this state of pure love is something that must be preserved and is easily lost, and takes work to regain. For his part, Caspian gave up on regaining it and sailed away to find Aslan to ask for advice on the matter, which is, of course, the right thing to do. Rillian is the main attraction of the book. Its central themes all revolve around him, and he is the focus of the plot, and the story begins and ends with him. Thus, the central theme of the book is divine heavenly love, the love of God for the world and Christ's love shown in the provisions of needs. This is what Rillian represents, or rather, the human imitation of God's love. This is not romantic love necessarily, it can include it, but instead includes care for all things. Here the English language is actually excellent, for it only has one word for love. It overreaches all things, just like God's love, and the English word love. Now Rillian spends a great majority of the story ensorcelled, a prisoner who is not himself, and locked deep within the earth. This goes into the difficulty of maintaining a godly mindset. It must be found and dredged up. It's no mere warning that the end times will feature love grown cold. Rillian, as the accursed Black Knight, is very cold. Some may even say abolished. In juxtaposition to pure love, Rillian, as Black Knight, is a soulless, carnal man enslaved to a wicked being known as the Lady of the Green Kirtle. She is a were-snake, the snake version of a werewolf, the very snake that killed Rillian's mother, and is the one who cursed Rillian. Her ultimate desire is control and power, the curse of Eve. She has brainwashed many. She has an army of gnomes and the prince to lead them. Her ultimate goal is conquest. Specifically, she has undermined Narnia and intends to conquer it. She is another characterization of one of Lewis's big thoughts, the removal of morality and the implementation of amoral power structures led by maniacs. He wrote a sci-fi novel about this, That Hideous Strength, book 3 of the Space Trilogy, likely a subject of a future episode, in which maniacal professors attempt to take over the world. Again, education and Lewis. He wrote a book of essays also on the subject, The Abolition of Man, and wrote The Silver Chair. As the Black Knight, Rillian is a vapid, scattered man who talks only in buzzwords, propaganda phrases, and has only one consistent trait, that he is at the lady's command. He is, for a visual metaphor, corporate art, that ugly, squiggly stuff that Facebook puts everywhere. Bland, dreamt up by others, fake, and nothing more than a tool of domination. He's got nothing else. This is the ultimate end of worldly love, worldly systems, and anything else separated from the truth of God. Look at social media. Look at politics. Look at history. Look at the divorce rate. Unless God builds the house, you labor in vain to try at all. Hence, the wisdom of Caspian to sail again in search of Aslan. In contrast, Rillian, freed from magic, first during his imprisonment on the Silver Chair, and later freed entirely, is a man alive. He bellows threats, he roars bombastically, he makes personal entreaties, he's real. It's also here, in the throes of reality, he asks for the children to free him in Aslan's name. This is probably my favorite moment of the book. There are many times in life that God's voice seems muddled. And then there are the times it rings clear and the moon and the sun stop spinning for a moment. Usually those moments are times of primal fear. Pain, terror, horror, impossibility. Take your pick. Usually because they constitute a breaking of the rules. God has the ways he works. At least, we think that. Sort of like sorcery, we use presuppositions to tell God exactly how we receive our orders. Quit your job, take the job, move there, go there, read the book, ask the girl out, break up with the girl, stop reading the book, start the podcast, do this, do that, eat there, don't eat there. Who deigns to tell God what to do? The response in the book is my favorite. They look at each other, acknowledge what they must do, shake hands expecting death, and set the madman free. Usually it turns out good when doing what God wants. Usually. It turns out good here. Rillian is free, and he takes his sword and destroys the chair. He is free now to function as Prince of Narnia, but only for a moment, for then the lady returns and begins to renew the magic the way garments and sorcerers do best. through music and education. She kindles a magic fire, begins playing repetitive hypnotic notes on a mandolin, and begins working through the gang's delusions, namely convincing them that stars, lions, and the entire surface world do not exist. This is the goal of all who wish to control the people, to take and break and divide from God and make slaves. And I regret to inform you that most of the world is set up to do this, to blot out love and to blot out God. Here is the core of Lewis's argument, God's love versus worldly love. And the answer is simple. Turn it off. Puddle Glum, the Marsh Wiggle, puts his foot into the fire and breaks the witch's attempts. Now, Puddle Glum, as the one to do this, is a key thing. He is an eternally pessimistic creature, less glass half empty type person, and more the glass is cracked and slowly leaking out. Being able to shut out the bewitchments of the world takes a certain pessimism. To be able to say, oh no, not this one too, and still turn it off. Admit, for instance, that the large animation company may be detrimental to children. Know it's not to be emulated, enjoy Emperor's New Groove, and be untouchable. You don't have to blot everything out, but just know it's not a paragon of virtue. By the way, guess which medievalist writer had sharp criticisms of Disney even in the 1930s? With that, I must weigh my main criticism of the book. Puddle Glum informs the witch that even if the world above, Aslan included, is a delusion, he chooses it over the underworld. Sadly, epic though it is wrong. St. Paul says in 1 Corinthians that if Jesus is not real, Christians should be utterly pitied. This is the clunkiness of Lewis's format for theological delivery, because it's a great fantasy moment, but theologically poor. I don't have much more to say other than that's a criticism that I have and an important thing to remember. It's here that the witch commits her most heinous crime of all. Heinous? Either way, it's terrible, and it constitutes her dropping her mandolin. Terrible thing to do. This is because she is turning into her snake form and losing her arms. Stripped of the power of musical and educational deception, she resorts to raw violence, the natural way of things. In this state, worldly love is at its ultimate expression. It's nothing but aggression and the inflicting of wrongs to your own benefit. But as in the real world, heavenly love is stronger stuff, and Rillian, with Puddle Glum's help, cuts her down and sends her down to hang out with, presumably, Susan in the end times. Her slaves are now free. The threat against Narnia ended, and Rillian is free. His first desire, after meeting with a newly freed gnome, is to go deeper into the earth, to, as the gnome puts it, to see the salamanders. Here is Lewis's final medieval parting shot. For in medieval folklore, the salamander is a sort of lizard that is immune to fire, and symbolizes Christ going down to hell to save souls. And the entire symbolism of the silver chair is summed up in this image. They decide against it because they want to make sure Caspian sees his son before he dies. They return to the surface, and Caspian sees Rillian on his deathbed. But Aslan is not yet done with Caspian. He resurrects him and sends him on one final quest. He goes to purge the experimental school. The bullies are beaten, and the incident results in the entire school leadership being fired and going on to live happily ever after as politicians. So that is the silver chair, a powerful display of the conquering of heavenly love overthrowing systems of control. It's pretty clear that the world is sick. The bread's been poisoned, relationships poisoned, friendships poisoned, economy poisoned. No matter who you are, everything feels poisoned. This is good. It's not supposed to be right. Yet. Correcting it is Christ's job. Our only job is to do what he tells us to do, even if we fail. So ends this episode of Lionskin. I think you're going to have a great week. Follow me at Lionskin Podcast on Instagram again, and until we meet again.